proudly student and listener supported community radio. CIUT 89.5 FM, celebrating 35 years as the sound of your city.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the producers and or the persons appearing on the program and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of CIUT FM.
I'm overcoming a cold, but it's sort of fun to be Whispering Smith once in a while. We're going to talk to Norman Otis Richmond about the book Welcome to Blackhurst, published by a different publisher. And, of course, you can find it at a different book list on Bathurst Street at Bloor on the east side, southeast. And it's an important book, wonderful photographs, pictures I've never seen, and I thought I'd seen them all, of really outstanding figures of the black community, and particularly their association with Bathurst Street, and hence Blackhurst. Charles Roach, of course, is one of the more prominent, and I'm proud to say I was his investigator for a number of years, and that was wonderful and an education. And I got to see a hero up close who never blinked, never feared anything. Again, it's a Taylor Report. It is CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. The interview with Norman Otis Richmond will be coming up probably in about 15 minutes, I expect. I want to begin by talking about, of course, all the world's tensions, issues that sort of jump out at us that deserve, I think, comment. Particularly, what I guess they need is measurement, analysis, because almost all reporting is dishonest and misrepresenting. I think I'm getting an indication Norman might be with us. Is that true? Hello, Norman?
Yes, sir, I'm here. How are you?
I just said you're going to be here in 15 minutes, so you are quick. This is Norman. And thanks for being early. I knew you were probably ready to go, but anyhow, it's great to hear your voice. How are you doing?
Good. I always ran first on the relay, so. I was the leadoff man while singing. I used to open up the show, be the first one off the blocks. I was always a good starter.
Yeah. By the way, Aaron Judge is in town tonight, ball player. I know you were a track and field man. Did you play baseball?
Let me give you my baseball story.
Absolutely.
My father wanted me to play baseball, and he bought me a first base glove and was showing me how to, you know, to stretch and all of that. And my father was 6 feet even.
Uh-huh.
And I would kind of laugh at him. I'd say, "Pop,
uh-huh,
you know, I'm too short to play first base. Plus, you know, first baseman should be at least 6 feet and left-handed, you know, so they can catch the ball and do all of that kind of stuff."
Yeah.
And I say, "I don't want to play first base. I want to play center field. I want to be Willie Mays."
Yes.
So all the girls could be screaming when you, yeah. Huh. I was very good at catching the ball. We couldn't throw and I couldn't hit. Plus, I went to John C. Fremont High School in Los Angeles, and John C. Fremont produced more National League baseball players in any other high school in the United States, so I didn't have a chance.
my problem with being a ball player at that age is that, you know, high school, you run into guys who are 6 feet two, 140 pounds, but can throw a ball like lightning, except they can't control it. And I thought,
hey,
this was pre-helmet time, and I thought, this doesn't seem like a good idea.
Well, you know who went to school with me was Bobby Tolan. He won a World Series. I think he was. He was with the Cincinnati Reds at one time, and with the St. Louis Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
And he was. Eddie Tolan, I think, was his uncle. His uncle was a great Olympic man. I think 36 Olympics. Oh. But I remember Bobby Tolan's boy. Bobby Tolan's son got shot by the police. He was going to be playing for the Washington Capitals, but Robbie Tolan was shot by the police. He was never able to play baseball again, but he did not die.
Yeah.
But, you know, I...
Now, you're saying Tolan, T-O-L-A-N?
T-O-L-A-N, Bobby Tolan.
Yeah, wasn't there a Tolan that played in the National Football League, was a punt returner?
I don't know that.
We're good at these names, I got to tell you. I'll bet there's people racing to find their sports books. By the way, this is Norman Otis Richmond. And the book, Norman, that you've written and contributed to, Welcome to Blackhurst, I noticed there are, in the collection of personalities spoken of, there's a Sam Richardson who was the 1936 Olympian. And that, it didn't take long for the black community of Canada, but I guess the Blackhurst community, they contributed to track and field very, very prominently.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Richardson ran in the 36 Olympics, and Leonard Johnston's wife, Gwen Johnston, they were the co-owners of Third World Books and Crafts. Samuel Richardson, they were first cousins, and she tells a story how, you know, when he got off the train, I guess after the Commonwealth Games, you know, whatever... basically the whole African Canadian community met him at a Union Station.
I wish those stories were better told in the United States because of all the turmoil and highly publicized incidents. These stories tend to be, and the names tend to be better known. The story of Jesse Owens. The story of Jackie Robinson and his brother. His brother was also at those games. And
I'll give you a story about Mr. Richardson. He was he worked for CBC, and I was blessed to have known him fairly well. You know the story, and you can see it on YouTube. He ran the first leg of the relay with Jesse Owens. Mm-hmm. And he actually beat Jesse, passed the baton before Jesse Owens.
That is, by the way, you say you had the privilege of knowing him.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, tell us about him a little bit, because that's the beauty of this book. We're being introduced to people. There's great photographs of them. And you've made a nice contribution here. You also, like myself, but I know more that you had wider experience than I did. You know many of the people in this book. I didn't realize you knew Sam Richardson. Did you ever ask him about that? Did he talk about the 36 Olympics?
I spoke to him many, many times because I knew Mr. Richardson, and I also knew his son, Dougie Richardson, who was a great saxophonist, and he played with the Bernie Mac. He played with the OJs, and his son, one of his youngest sons was his name. Norman Richardson and people. Norman is still in the land of the living, and well, I used to get in trouble because I had his name, and Norman Richardson was quite a tough guy,
uh-huh.
and he he was notorious for he was like a defender of the black community, and he was still, like I say, he was still in the land of the living. But, you know, Mr. Richardson was when he passed away, he was very, he was still physically fit.
Mm-hmm.
I think he might have had a 28-inch waist. You know, he was extremely fit and extremely, he was sharp. He was a technician at the CBC. He could have went to school in the United States, but I think he was married. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was married, and he wanted to look after his family. So he turned that opportunity to go to college down to look after his mm-hmm. his children.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's Norman Otis Richmond as the guest, and Norman is best described as a bluesologist. Norman, I notice you have the first essay in this book, and you're talking about Al Hamilton, the founder and publisher of Contrast Newspaper, 28 Lexington Street. And he was the owner from 1969 to 1983. It seems like the right guy to start with, doesn't it, to open the book with Al Hamilton, because Contrast really set the pace in the black community. Talk about Al Hamilton and your thoughts about him, memory.
Well, Al Hamilton was, first of all, there is a long history of black people having newspapers in Canada. I think there were two newspapers, and I think it was started in Windsor. One was by Mary Ann Shad. I forgot her. Mary Ann Shad, she got married. And I'm having a senior moment, but Mary Ann Shad and there was another gentleman, they had papers in, I guess, 18, what am I talking about, many years ago. I'm having too many senior moments, but she had a newspaper, and then you had newspapers in the 40s in Canada. Not only in Toronto, but in other parts of Canada, but in the late 60s, Al Hamilton, along with Olivia Grange Walker, who is now the Minister of Culture in Jamaica today, mm-hmm. they started Contrast.
On Lenox Avenue, pardon me, Lenox Street.
28 Lenox, right. Right across the street from a different book where it's torn down now. Yes, right.
My gosh. I see that he worked at the Italian paper, Italian Canadian Corriere Canadese.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was. He had links with, the bad boys, and that's where he got his. After he was released, he went to prison, and mm-hmm. when he came out of prison, he started the newspaper, and he got his expertise working with the Italian newspapers, and he began Contrast. And you know, a lot of people had problems with Contrast because they said there were grammatical errors, and there were this, and there were that, and blah 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 blah. But
show me a paper actually in those days that didn't have those things.
Oh no, I think that was a lot of people are going to get mad at me. That was the British, mm-hmm. whole British, the British thing in terms of the correct English and all of that. But Al's roots were from Oklahoma. He came, I think he was born in Calgary, Alberta, but he was part of the Underground Railroad. When I say on the Underground Railroad, there were a group of people from Nebraska that escaped mm-hmm. and came to Canada, and Al Hamilton came from that's his stock, and he couldn't get a job, he was working on the railroad, and someone called him the N-word, and Al decked him, and lost his job, and had to resort to other ways of earning a living, so he got into the
He got around.
Crime, you got involved in quote unquote crime.
Well, do you know, if you know his story that well? I mean, how he got motivated that he thought, okay, now's the time to have this paper, Contrast.
No, that's exactly. He thought that he was going to, he wanted to, you know, basically spread the word and help people. Politically, he was in the ND. He was sympathetic to the NDP, but he didn't think the NDP could win. So like many people, he was not necessarily in love with Trudeau, but Trudeau had opened up the doors for, you know, black people from the United States and especially the Caribbean and Africa. So he, you know, he got on the Trudeau bandwagon, and Trudeau used to, for lack of a better term, he used to big up Contrast. And he had a wide variety of writers. Edwin, I forgot, there was a brother that was in prison. He was in prison in Ohio. Edwin Hogan, I think, was his name. He had a column in Contrast. I remember we put together an African, pardon me, African Liberation Day special in May 1972. We put that together with, I put that together with Muhammad Ahmed, a.k.a. Max Sanford, who once called the most dangerous man in America. And we put that paper together, and we had contributions from Horace Campbell and Walter Rodney. And that paper was circulated all over the Western Hemisphere that year. Yeah, I saw copies of that when I went to Los Angeles. And
did he realize how much impact he was having, and how that he was a pioneer on all that? Did he have a sense of that?
Yes, he did. Because when you went to Grenada, they had posters. I mean, they had billboards about Contrast in when Maurice Bishop, or when the New Jew movement came to power. They didn't recognize Contrast.
In your piece, it says Maurice Bishop, who would later become the Prime Minister of Grenada, did the layout for Contrast before the New Jew movement came to power in Grenada.
That is a fact. Yeah, he used to come in and lay the paper out sometimes. Lay the paper out on, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday night, and yeah, Maurice Bishop. I never saw him lay the paper out, but I met Maurice Bishop at Marcus Garvey Hall, the UNIA Hall here in Toronto.
That's something.
Yeah.
You list the number of, you say it's been a launch pad, Contrast launch pad for many familiar names, such as Cameron Bailey of the International Film Festival, Jojo Chinto, City TV, Royce and James, who wrote the introduction, by the way, to this book, Arnold August, Share newspaper, Makeda Silvera,
yes.
Who seems to be a very major picture. I think there's a photograph of her also in here.
Oh, yes. And
Cecil Foster, who I remember him writing features of the Globe and Mail. I didn't know he had been at Contrast. Diana Liverpool, who was a photographer. Al Peabody, who was a photographer. Hamlin Grange, president and co-founder of DiversaPro. And, of course, my goodness, Austin Clark, who is also a good friend of yours. Austin Clark is featured here. I mean, that really does tell you how important Contrast was, my gosh.
And it was free. And it was free, and one of the, I had some differences with Arnold August, Arnold Auguste. He used to write a column called "Let's Go to Church," and he never published me. He wouldn't let me write because. He thought I was a, you know, Mississippi Negro with, you know, illiterate Negro from Mississippi. You know, we were supposed to be idiots.
Uh-huh.
So he wouldn't let me write. And then it was Daryl Hawaii became the editor, and he let me write a column. And I think there was a big split, and Bromley Armstrong and Al Hamilton started a paper together, Islander. And the editor at that time was Daryl Hawaii, and he let me write my first article. I actually wrote an article, I think it was on Betty Wright, the singer, cleanup woman. And I believe that was the first time I ever got paid.
Yeah.
And then, when Al came back.
That makes you a writer. That's the dividing line. Somebody says, no, we want this, and we'll pay you for that.
Exactly.
You're not a poet anymore. We're going to pay you now. I remember reading Truman Capote said he couldn't imagine writing a word if he wasn't going to get paid, which I thought, wow, I thought everybody just wrote and then somebody gave them money.
Well, he used to say that what he's so-and-so-so, he's not a writer, he's a typist.
He said that about Jack Kerouac. That has to be one of the greatest lines anybody ever uttered. Yeah, he said, Norman, there's another Norman. Norman Mailer said he went on the show thinking he was the brightest kid in the block, and he was waiting to say something really smart. And so this guy Cavett, David, yeah, I forget his first name. Anyway, Cavett says, well, Kerouac seems to be the most exciting author right now. What do you think of Kerouac? And before Mailer could think of anything smart, Truman Capote said, well, that's not writing, that's typing. And Mailer said he went home depressed. He couldn't sleep.
But I remember, I guess I'm old enough to tell the story now, but I remember we were in a big meeting, and it was 50 people in the room. I remember I told Arnold August to his face, I say, the only thing Cher, your newspaper is good for is to wrap fish in, you know. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we made up, and I began to write. I wrote a column for him for a number of years. But, we had struggles. I shouldn't say we. I guess that's the way of the world. The world is full of contradictions, right?
Yeah. Now, again, the book is Welcome to Blackhurst, published by a different publisher, a cool name. And we're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond. Norman, I would suggest if you're going to rename the street, how about making it Leonard and Gwendolyn Johnston? Because to me, it was the third world books on Bathurst. Although, I mean, it knocked around. You point out they were on Walden, I think it was, and they were also on Bay Street. I remembered Lennon Johnson chasing me out of the store one time because I made a smart remark about Marcus Garvey wearing a funny hat. And Leonard did not think everything was funny, so he chased me. But I came back, you know, we got along.
I used to get chased out of his store.
He had a temper, didn't he?
Every other day.
Oh, good. I feel better. I thought I was making a confession.
He kicked me out one Saturday, and then he called me the next Monday morning. Otis, he's called me son. He says, son, how come you're not in the store today? I says, Negro, did you just kick me out on Saturday? I thought you didn't want me. And so he busts out laughing. You know, you're a little crazy, but
he did have a type of temper, but it was a curious personality trait. They were lovable people. Talk about, and Gwendolyn, she kept the store going, by the way, as well after we lost Albert. After we lost Leonard. By the way, wasn't he? He was also he's a graduate of the Pullman workers, right? I mean,
I just put on Facebook, Paul Anka. There's something about Paul Anka. He used to look after Paul Anka. Lenny looked after Paul Anka when Paul Anka was a kid. That was one of Lenny's jobs was to take Paul Anka when Paul Anka was 13, 14. He was, you know, he was singing at that time. And Lenny's job was to look after Paul Anka.
I think I got to say for sure, knowing the personality of Leonard Johnston, that he left a little mark on Paul Anka, because if, one of the great things about being around Leonard and Gwendolyn was that you always went away thinking a little bit different after you talked to him.
Oh yeah, well he told me a lot about he spent a lot of time with Paul Anka. Paul Anka is he's Lebanese, I believe.
Mm.
I think he's Arab, I believe. He's not a Western European, you know.
Well, what do you know? See, this is what we learned. If you can, Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist, and this is how you learn about the world. I didn't know either that Leonard had been a singer. He'd been a part of a group.
Yeah, if I didn't care. Yeah, he was.
Oh, he did that.
They used to.
Medium.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, no, I love the sound of that because I recognize it from, he's covering some of the best pop from the 50s.
Yeah, we used to have demonstrations in front of the U.S. consulate, and Lenny used to sing the song "We're a Winner" by the Impressions. Yeah, we used to sing that. But Lenny was basically, Gwen was a, Miss Johnston was across the board. You know, I remember we used to go to concerts. I remember going to concerts. We saw Wilson Pickett one time, and the show was so good, they had two shows, and Miss Johnston came out after the show and says, "Otis, I want to see him again. I'll buy you a ticket. You want to come and see him with me?" I said, yes, ma'am. And I remember we went to Buffalo, New York one time. Lenny, Miss Johnston, and Mr. Johnson, we went to see Smokey Robinson and Stephanie Mills, you know, because Miss Johnston liked all types of music, you know. Mm-hmm. She liked her jazz, but like she really loved James Brown.
Yeah, Third World books, to me, I mean, that was one of those little mecca. You know, think about how they've treated people. If you had a pamphlet you'd done or a paper that come in from somewhere, a radical paper, as it was, every paper was radical. You just take it over there, and he'd say, "Oh, yeah, put it on the shelf."
That's right. That's right. He
didn't say, "Let me read that. I'll decide." You know, no. He just said, "Go ahead, put it there."
And he also sold all of the radical stuff along with you. If you wanted a Bible or a Quran, you could buy that there too. But most of his books were. Lenny was for many years was a member of the Canadian Communist Party, so we had, and he was pro China.
Uh-huh.
So we had all of the books from China, Albania, India, and you know, but if you wanted a Quran by Maulana Muhammad Ali or by Yusuf Ali, you know.
Think about that. I mean, you made the point about his associating with China, his positive approach. It's very natural when you realize that at the height of the most powerful and violent time, the struggle against racism, when leaders are being killed practically every week, a prominent leader would be killed. And one of those prominent leaders, Robert Williams, went to China. And Mao Zedong stood on at Tiananmen Square alongside Robert Williams. That I could see why that would warm the heart of Leonard Johnston.
Oh, yeah. You remember Robert Williams came through Toronto, and he actually stayed with Ann Olsen. I forgot the other. the brother who the European guy that hid Robert and Mabel Williams. I actually used to go by their house all of the time. The Olsons.
Mm-hmm.
They were affiliated with Leon Trotsky's organization, and I remember when the story is that when they Robert Williams escaped from Toronto, he went to Nova Scotia, and the Trots, the so-called Trots and the so-called Stalinists, all they worked together and got Robert Williams
and
out.
They managed to do that without dropping the package.
Right. And
good for them.
He passed away now, so we can talk about it.
Uh-huh.
So he got on a ship in Nova Scotia or Newfoundland and made his way to Cuba.
Think about that. I'm really glad you raised that story because Jack Johnson passed through Canada when they were looking for him in the States to put him in prison for the great crime of paying a woman's transportation fees to cross a state line. She was in trouble and she phoned him and said, I need help. And he said he wired her money. And then the great baseball commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, charged Jack Johnson for paying a woman of ill fame to cross a state line. And the federal government went to work to get him. And he pretended he was a member of a baseball team and crossed the border into Canada. And I forget what happened after that, although I know he got away.
Right.
Isn't that a great... I mean, you got to say, Canada, you're doing your part.
That's when I remember Red Fox had the joke. If you see me with a white woman, I'm holding it for the police because of that.
Yeah.
Just to be Emmett Till, you know, got killed allegedly for whistling at a white woman, and Jack Johnson had all of those troubles because he had relationships with European women.
Oh my God! Yes.
I mean, when I say he had legitimate relations, those were his his friends or his wives, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. By the way, that's a story we have to tell someday. It was about the black fighters who used to come here. The famous fighter from Nova Scotia who became known as the, if I can use the term, I guess, Boston Tar Baby. His name won't come to me, but he fought in Toronto. You notice, by the way, this is called Free Association, but they just decided they're not going to have the trophy called the Lou Marsh Trophy anymore. And I'm remembering the name. Lou Marsh wrote about Sam Lankford, the heavyweight challenger to Jack Johnson. And he made fun of his eyes. He made fun of his lips. He made fun of what he assumed was the diet of Sam Lankford. And the whole column. And all these years, everybody said, oh, Lou Marsh. They finally just now said, maybe we shouldn't do that anymore. But it's tied into all these things. We're speaking Norman Otis Richmond.
Sam Lankford was from... He was Nova Scotian, right?
Yeah, he was from Nova Scotia. He had been really a hardworking young man who, like a lot of young men, who got into argument with his father about how much work to be done that day. And he crossed the water and went to Boston to get a job in a bar. And they found out that he could knock out all the patrons if he needed to. So they said, maybe we should put this guy in a ring and all of us make a lot of money off him. So a fabulous man, by the way. He was one of the greatest fighters ever. And when he died in New York City. The mayor interrupted a meeting. He heard that Sam was not well, and he said, "Meeting adjourned. I got to go see about Sam Lankford."
Has there been any books or films about him? I know his name, and I don't know any details about him.
There are most of them have been somewhat slight. There are stories of his career and you know, he and Jack Johnson went all the way back. They fought as young men, and the story always was the legend that Jack Johnson did not want to fight him, which, as you know, and we should share this with the listeners, what Jack Johnson said, there's no money in me fighting another black man. The way I make money is fighting white men, because they're all trying to come and get me.
Uh-huh.
And he said, so he was thinking like a businessman. You can't blame him. But Sam Lankford, yeah, Nova Scotia. And there is a museum, a Lankford museum near his hometown. I forget the name of it. But I'm glad we're on all these things because, again, by the way, we're talking about the book, Welcome to Blackhurst, and it's from a different publisher, cool name, which, and of course is a different book list, which is on the east side of Bathurst. It's just south of Bloor, and everybody ought to get a copy of it. Did you know that Judge Carter's talked about here? I saw him in courtrooms working for Charles and others, but I didn't know the person.
I think his daughter is Linda. I believe Linda Carter is his daughter. Mm. And I know Linda Carter very, very well. And Linda is a model, and she was on a lot of albums, a lot of Isaac Hayes' albums, and on the cover of those albums. And she is very close to a young man who I used to babysit H.B. Barnum. H.B. Barnum was, he says he's 21 years old now, so mm-hmm. He says I used to babysit him. But anyway, he was with Aretha Franklin for,
well,
he was a director for like 25 years, but, and he was very, he and Linda Carter.
The guy that you babysat was with Aretha?
I'm saying that's HB talking. HB
yeah.
says, I used to babysit him, but he was born, he was my next door neighbor, and I lived at 1333 Kearney Street in Aliso Village in Los Angeles.
Mm.
No, HB was just talking. He was just talking funny. Yeah.
Mm.
He told me the last time I talked to him was 2 days ago. He says, if I can control the snow, he'll come up and see me. if I can stop it from snowing. Other than that, he's not coming.
Norman Otis Richmond. Look, and you know, I don't know if you paged through it. I know you're one of the contributors to the book, but this is just fun just to look at the pictures. And I'm looking at Harry Gary Sr., Harry Gary Ice Rink, 275 Bathurst Street. He lived from 1898 to 1993. And I was always so impressed when I saw Harry Gary, because he had a very distinctive demeanor. That's my memory of him. You're instantly impressed with the guy. You must have known Harry.
Harry Gary adopted me when I came to Toronto. I didn't live in his house, but he took me under his wing when I first came to Toronto and introduced me to lots of people. I think Mr. Gary was born in Cuba, mm-hmm. and his.
They say no. I may as well. I'll do a footnote. I think he'd born in Jamaica and taken to Cuba when he was 5 years old. So you're right, in the sense that he was raised there.
Yeah. And his nephew is still in the land of the living. His nephew's name is Lucky. Lucky Gary is a barber, mm. and he was a musician. He was a great musician, but he's a barber today. And, yeah, Lucky and Mr. Gary's second wife. I remember his second wife. I used to go by their house, and Mr. Gary would, he took a for some reason, and he used to own the Whiff Club, you know, the Whiff Club, the West Indian Federation. It was across the street from on college. It was on right across the street from the Universal Negro Improvement Association, Garvey Hall.
Yes.
On College Street. So Mr. Gary owned the Whiff Club, and he was also worked on the railroad with Lenny and those people, with Lenny mm-hmm. and a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at Lloyd's, I guess it is, barbershop. Lloyd's Barbershop, is that right?
Yeah, Lloyd's, that's where my son got his first haircut. Lloyd's.
Now we're talking. This is history. This is why we're getting at this. Does he remember that?
Yes, he does. Lloyd passed away, but Lloyd was on, let me check, the Bathurst Street, the first, you got off the subway, the first across the street was Joyce's food, it was a food place. And Joyce was a Jamaican woman. She had my wife used to make me, I used to live in Don Mills, and I used mm-hmm. to have to get on the subway and the bus to get my wife fish and all kind of Caribbean food. And I had to go all the time. Otherwise, she would have divorced me. Next to Joyce, you had Lloyd's Barbershop. Then you had Lloyd had a barber shop, and he used to work for Solomon. Solomon was a boxer. He still Solomon is still there, and Lloyd is still there. But Solomon's book, Solomon had about 25, 26, maybe 27 chairs in his barber shop, and he was a heavyweight boxer, Jamaican. Wow. He made his name in England. I think he might own Bathurst. He owned a large part of Bathurst Street.
Yeah.
Next to him, you had Bev Masco. That was a beauty parlor.
Uh-huh.
That was Bev Masco. She had a beauty parlor there. Next to her, you had Theo's record store. That was owned by a Bajan. Theo was a man, so they named it after him. But the person who ran the record store was a woman. I cannot remember their sister's name.
Uh-huh.
And she was a rhythm and blues fanatic. Like, if you wanted some reggae or some calypso, you didn't go to her.
Wow. But
if you wanted some Al Green and some Betty Wright and, you know, James Brown, you went to Theo's.
Isn't that something? By the way, I noticed this barbershop, some of the customers include... Lennox Lewis,
yeah,
and educator Zenana Akande, who is also featured in the book,
right?
And so that'd be the place to be, wouldn't it?
Reuben Carter, what's the brother's name that used to play center field for the Blue Jays? Is from Jamaican brother.
That's a challenge. I could almost do it, except I can never answer a question if I'm asked. I have to be on the sidelines.
Born in Devon White.
Yeah. It was on the tip of my tongue.
It was like the Europeans call him, it's supposedly Devon, but I forget that the Europeans would always mess his name up. Yeah, he got his hair cut there, Lennox Lewis, Reuben Carter. I think they used to send somebody out to Reuben's house and to cut Reuben's hair, you know, everybody went there.
You know, of course, it's become now a kind of cultural phenomenon that now the barbershop is focused on. I remember way, way back when Spike Lee began to do interviews in black barbershops. Now everybody's imitating that, and there are movies that are built around them. Was this barbershop that sort of cultural meeting place?
Yes. it was like being in a barbershop in Toronto was just like being in a barbershop in Los Angeles. I had a cousin, Herman Butler, who used to have, who worked at a barbershop, and my father used to take me there on many Saturdays. And, you know, it would be, you know, you would go to the barbershop and you would listen to all these men. You know, every man in there was a 60-minute man. He could make love to a woman for 60 minutes and knock out Mike Tyson and outrun Jesse Owens and Usain Bolt. Sit up and listen to, you know, it's all all of these people.
That's an education.
These men were from Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, and all of the, all of the fairy tales from black people in the South.
Yeah. We're speaking Norman Otis Richmond. The book is Welcome to Blackhurst, an iconic Toronto neighborhood. Different book list is on the east side of Bathurst at Bloor, southeast. Do go there, check it out. And Norman, speaking to you earlier, I said I wanted to, and you've given me a good segue because you mentioned this woman who was a rhythm and blues fanatic. And I've been, I was watching this film Elvis, which pained me a great deal, but I was looking, I wanted to see the scene where Elvis allegedly heard Big Mama Thornton singing Hound Dog. And it was very short, and I was disappointed in that. But the woman herself, the great performer, Big Mama Thornton, she's quite a story. The detail I want to throw into the conversation, I want to see her. You can go, as you know, to find a grave. So I thought, well, we lost her in 1984. I wanted to see what they say about her at her grave. And at the picture, there's three names. And I thought, whoa, so that's a cousin, a husband, a brother. You know what it is? It's three bodies. It's an indigent grave. So they got her name in the middle of two other names. And that's Big Mama Thornton. I don't understand how this could be, but anyhow, could you talk about her, and you can take up Elvis along the way if you like.
Well, Big Mama Thornton was in the room when there was a young man named Johnny Ace, and Johnny Ace, he did the song Forever, My Darling, My Da Da Da, you know, My Love. Mm-hmm. And Johnny Ace was the biggest African American star in Jamaica. I remember going, when I went, the first time I went to Jamaica, there was a record store. This is in the 70s. I go to Jamaica and I walk, going to the record store in Kingston, Jamaica, and the first thing I see is a big poster with the Johnny Ace's picture. Anyway, Johnny Ace was in the room with Big Mama Thornton, and he was playing Russian roulette. I think it was Christmas Eve or maybe Christmas Day, playing Russian roulette, and he actually blew his brains out. And
It was an accident, right? He was playing with a gun.
Yeah, but it was loaded.
And she was watching.
Yeah.
And saw it happen.
And Johnny Ace was a bit of a, he was a genuine character, you know. He was a real, very talented, genuine character. And she was there.
Yeah.
And I remember she was a very passionate, very bright woman, but she never got her due. Never ever got her due. I haven't seen the Elvis movie. I definitely want to see it.
It strikes me that she didn't have the art of self-promotion the way some do.
Uh, was you was definitely not Little Richard. When I, you know, I don't think anybody had people didn't know about that promotion thing. Like I know a guy by the name of Charles Burnett, great filmmaker. He is the what is it called? He won a MacArthur Award, $500,000, and
whoa.
He is the man who, you know, doesn't promote it. I mean, you have certain people that are so humble that they. I think Mama Thornton was like that. And then, you know, they pay people. That's part of the industry now. You pay a public relations person to pump you up, put your name in the paper. You know, no matter what you do, what they say, any publicity is good publicity.
Yeah, that's that realm of the agent. By the way, which is a big factor in the movie, A Story of Elvis. I think I might have mentioned to you. To me, they should have called the movie Colonel Parker, because it's actually about the guy who the hustler knew how to promote him and to tell him who to associate with and who not to associate with, the sound not to make, when to make the sound, and, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of artists can't take that. I mean, they say, the heck with you. I mean, you know.
Well, you know, while we're talking about it, I don't know if we've ever talked about it, but Elvis' biggest influence, one of his biggest influence was Roy 7X Hamilton. I just hold me tight and don't let go. You never walk alone.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Roy Hamilton was a card-carrying member of the Nation of Islam.
Ah.
Very close to Muhammad Ali, very close to Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
That was Elvis. Elvis was that was one of Elvis's biggest influence was Roy Hamilton.
You know, it is that thing of influence is kind of is curious. I love to just say the name Ray Charles because he was so powerful and influential, and he wanted to be like, oh my gosh,
Roy Brown.
Oh, who is the pop singer, the black pop singer who made it so big, and.
Nat King Cole? Or
yeah, Roy? Nat King Cole. He wanted to sing like Nat King Cole.
So did Oscar Peterson.
And it, now when you hear Ray Charles, you don't think of Nat King Cole.
No, but you don't.
That, this thing about influence is really curious. I thought it is sad that we have this, this woman who performed, played the part, of Big Mama Thornton, whose real name was Willie Mae Thornton. Her father was a preacher. The young woman, they said she's on the brink of a great career, and she herself has died at the age of 44, the woman who played Big Mama Thornton.
Where was Big Mama Thornton? Where was she born?
Apparently she started a lot of arguments. She wanted it to be a city in Alabama, but apparently the birth certificate says it was a little town in Alabama.
Okay.
She was really something. Of course, there's also the thing about the song, Hound Dog. I did not know until very recent that song was written specifically for her by Stoller and the other guy. I forget who.
Lieber, I think. Lieber
and Stoller. Who were those guys are geniuses. There's no question. And they wanted her to sing it. And I read a quote from Lieber. He said, I don't know what Elvis is going on about in this song. He says, there's no rabbit in the song.
He said,
that business about a rabbit. No, it was actually, of course, a rhythm and blues song. It was about a woman who's tired of a gigolo who keeps coming around her house, bothering her. And she said, I'm not letting you in. Which, as you know, that was one of the great themes of rhythm and blues. I always liked that song. I hear you knocking, but you can't come in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You must know that song. That was a great song.
I hear you, but you can't. Yeah, I know that song. my father was a bluesologist. Yeah, I knew all of.
So you're bluesologist number two.
My pops was he was down with all of the music up until he passed away. He was up to date. He loved
Tell us a story. You mentioned to me that you actually brought, this is amazing, Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist, comes home, I guess a teenager, and you brought Elvis home to play?
I brought Elvis.
He didn't like that.
Oh, no. Yeah, what happened was I took my two sisters to see, let me stop lying. We went and bought, I think it was Teddy Bear or All Shook Up. Mm-hmm. We actually purchased the 45.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what they cost, 99. I don't know what they cost back at that time. We actually purchased the record and brought it home. And I remember I showed it to my father and we bought Elvis. And my father he was a race man. He wasn't a race man like my grandfather. My grandfather, you couldn't put a white piece of paper in front of my grandfather.
But
my father was, he was Huey P. Newton. He did not like the police. So we brought home Elvis, and he almost had a heart attack. It's like, oh, my God.
And I think you said he doubled up on that because you also brought the Beatles home. He had the same reaction.
Yeah, but the point was, he says, look, as I was always saying, it's like, I brought you up on Nat King Cole, my sister's name, Sweet Lorraine, after Lorraine, after Sweet Lorraine. Uh-huh. I brought you listening to Nat King Cole, mm-hmm. Don Washington, Muddy Waters, Jimmy Reed, and, you know, all of the best music, black music in the world. And you guys go out and buy this. little Mississippi white guy, come on.
That's exactly how I felt about the Rolling Stone. Well, we've been talking to Norman Otis Richmond, and we're not going to cheat anybody out of something. We're going to play a bit of Big Mama Thornton, Hound Dog, and end this all up. Norman, it's been great talking to you. Welcome to Blackhurst. Now I can't say the real name. Anyway, thanks an awful lot.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right, Taylor Report. Here's some Mama Thornton, I believe. I'll wait till she shows up. And Phil Connor was going to be with us today, but he's probably at home listening to this.